live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to take a look at several issues. We're going to examine the president's speech. I feel that there were a few things that were important that were not said. Plus, I'll challenge some of the things that were said. In fact, I'll challenge the entire Washington consensus, all those people either applauding or sitting on their hands, because they do not represent you and I. And they haven't for a long time. It's just one giant game. It's like everything else in Las Vegas. None of it's real. It's all an illusion. So I'll take it on. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. We have a lot of people suffering from arthritis. A new study from the University of California talks about how bacteria in milk is linked to rheumatoid arthritis. A strain of bacteria commonly found in milk and beef may be a trigger for developing rheumatoid arthritis in people who are at risk. And this is what this team found. And they published it in Frontiers in Cellular and Infectious Microbiology. One of the reasons that I suggest not to eat any animal proteins is because you have to understand anatomy, a basic fact. When you are alive, your immune system, and there's many components to the immune system, are going through your body at all times, every cell. It's being monitored. Your blood is a highway of these messengers, lymphocytes, phagocytes, neutrophils, basophils, all these different natural immune modulators. When they see something that doesn't belong there, they generally engulf it, what is called phagocytosis, and dissolve it enzymatically. So when you're alive, your immune system is constantly on your guard. The moment you die, and it's true for an animal, the immune system stops. However, everything was pathogenic, the germs, the bacteria, the viruses, the parasites, they continue thriving because there's nothing to keep them in check. If I ask you to eat an apple that had been sitting out in the sun for 3 days at 97 degrees, you would say, no, that's not a good idea. Yet it already began to decay. It's going through a fermentation process. That's why it has a very acidy smell. It wouldn't kill you, but it certainly wouldn't be palatable. Now, if it went long enough, and if you dried it under the right conditions, it would go through that, and then all the moisture would dry out, and then you have a dry piece of apple. Now ask yourself, would you do the same thing for a piece of meat? Let's just take a piece of meat, any kind, chicken, fish, beef, put it in the sun, even on a clean plate, for 3 days at 97 degrees, would you eat it? Because that's exactly what's happening in your intestine. There has been some modulation through hydrochloric acid, but it has not impacted the parasites, has not stopped the bacteria. Bacteria can live at the bottom of a volcano. It can live at the top of the Arctic Circle, encased in ice, thaw the ice, and you can end up with what is called a zombie virus or a zombie bacteria. In fact, just this last year, there was an outbreak of anthrax in Siberia when some, I believe it was caribou that had been frozen in the tundra, in the permafrost. Now, permafrost is generally, let's say, 6, 8, 10 feet of your topsoil down, frozen solid. But with global warming, it releases the ice, and then when you walk on the ground, you go right up to your knees in it. It's soft, which means that anything in there is really percolating bacteria. Now, then suddenly a frozen carcass, let's say the carcass died from anthrax, or human died from tuberculosis or smallpox. That smallpox or tuberculosis could be reinvigorated. And that's why they call it zombie viruses. And so you can get yourself infected. Handle any ancient thawed material of human or animal origin, and you can end up with infections. So now look at the animal you just are eating. Now, you'll say that because it's kosher, it's safe. It's not. That's a myth. That's just an observance of minimizing the suffering of the animal. But then go to an actual plant and see whether or not you're satisfied by your own personal observation. Did the animal die a peaceful death, or did it die in fear and trauma? And either way, the animal is dead, their immune system stops, all that was protecting that animal from disease is gone. So now in that animal's cells, you have hundreds of trillions with a T, of microorganisms that are all in decay mode. And that's why we call it the smell of death. If you smell a dead rat or a dog or cat or any animal, you know it's something that has died. Now imagine back in the 1800s, you're on a cattle drive. You took cattle from the northern country, up around Montana, North Dakota, Colorado, Wyoming. Those were our Great Plains states where cattle could roam for months on end because there was plenty of grass and water. And then at a certain time, you would start herding them, generally in the fall. You would bring them down before the winter when they're really heavy, 1,000, 1,200 pounds. And you'd bring them down to Abilene. You'd bring them down to Texas, at least the northern part of Texas, which butts up against Oklahoma. And there they would be sold and taken on trains to different parts of the United States where people wanted their livestock. But people didn't like the beef by that time because the long walk, getting them from Montana down to Texas or wherever they were taken, meant that the fat that they had built up substantially was burned off, and now they had really tough muscle. So eating a piece of meat, even though it was, you know, organic grain, grass-fed, didn't mean that it was tender. It wasn't. So meat was, you had to chew on it and chew and chew and chew. But there was another way of making meat more palatable. You would put it into a room, hanging on a hook, and then that room would be warm. In another room, you'd have blocks of ice and it'd be cool. So every 24 hours, you would then move that group of animals from one warm room to a cool room. That would speed up and slow down, speed up and slow down, what amounted to the rotting of the animal. The flesh was rotting. And after about 30 days of this rotting, and the smell of this house would have been unbelievably foul. Just imagine how gross it would be. Then you would take the meat to the local restaurant. And with no sanitation, because they had no indoor running water, you would cut up that meat on a table where you prepared any other kind of food. There was no hygiene. And you would cook it. Then the meat would be soft enough that you could cut it with a fork. It was called prime-aged cut. Now think of the metaphor. Think of the synonym. Think of how we manipulate words against something that they actually mean. Prime-aged, the real world is rotting, decomposed flesh. Well, nobody wants to look at a menu and say, give me some of that rotting, decomposed, smelly flesh. Oh, and by the way, don't put the sodium nitrite on it so it looks red. I want it purplish brown. Oh, and don't scrape off or put in that bucket of chemicals to kill off the mold on it. I want the mold. I want it to smell like a zombie would eat it. That's how I want my meat. Because that's what you're eating. Today, that's what you're eating. Think of this remote. Do you really think a piece of meat is red? Since when did meat become red? Let me give you an example of how stupid we are. Cut your finger. It turns red, the blood. But then immediately the blood clots. We have a clotting factor. Then it turns from red to a dark red, then dark, then purple. That's scabbing. You've had oxidation of your red blood cells. A piece of meat is the same. And that's why meat is chemically treated with sodium nitrite to maintain and fix the color red. Oh, that looks good. That looks red. I want blood red. No, you don't. It's really purple-black. Purple-black? How many people do you think would eat a purple-black or dark gray smelly piece? And then let's use another chemical to kill the smell. So, and then let's speed up its aging process so it's easier to chew. In any case, I share all this with you as just one reason why. If it's dead, you bury it, you don't eat it. All right? And all animal proteins, I don't care if they're kosher or not, it's irrelevant to your health. It all produces disease. There's no health benefits to eating meat. It's that simple. But we won't give it up. We're eating more this year than ever before because we like the taste of it and how it's prepared. But you pay a price, and one price is arthritis. That's according to this study. Another study from Ohio University shows that vitamin D3 could help heal or prevent cardiovascular damage. Now, this is very important. And it doesn't take a lot. It's just a little more than sunlight can help restore damage to your cardiovascular system. The study shows that vitamin D3, which is made by the body naturally when the skin is exposed to the sun, can significantly restore the damage to the cardiovascular system caused by severe disease, including hypertension, diabetes, or atherosclerosis. And we're talking about something you can get by going out into the sun. If you spend 20 minutes in the sun, you create about 20,000 units of vitamin D. This study, done by a distinguished professor, Malinsky, and others at the university, was published in the International Journal of Nanomedicine. Quote, generally, vitamin D3 is associated with the bones. However, in recent years in clinical settings, people recognize that many patients have a heart attack, will have a deficiency of vitamin D3. It doesn't mean that the deficiency caused the heart attack, but it increased the risk of heart attack. We use nanosensors to see why vitamin D3 can be beneficial, especially for the function and restoration of cardiovascular system. So they did this measurement. Then they wanted to see how much vitamin D. By the way, most people are not aware of this. You know, I suggest you to take beet juice every day because it helps create nitric oxide, which is a major signaling molecule in the regulation of blood flow and the prevention of the formation of clots in the cardiovasculature. Well, vitamin D3 is a powerful stimulator of nitric oxide. And that's important. Also, D3 significantly reduced the level of oxidative stress to the cardiovascular system. So, if you've had a heart attack or a stroke, two ways of dealing with it. One, take about 5,000 units of vitamin D3 each day. Two, go to a sunny environment, such as Florida or Texas or Southern California, a place where you can be in the sun for at least an hour with about two-thirds of your body exposed. I'll put a pair of shorts on, a bathing suit, lay in the sun each day. That will do you a great deal of good and help prevent a second heart attack. But it also helps thin out the blood because of that nitric oxide it's helping to create. And that is very, very important. Something simple. It's not complicated. For those of you who have cravings for food and drugs, according to the City University of London, mindfulness can reduce the cravings. Now, I talk about mindfulness meditation a lot here and how it can help prevent different addictive behavior. Well, now it can help prevent and interrupt cravings for food and drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, marijuana, by occupying short-term memory. That's according to this study. So looking at experimental studies that have examined the effects of different types of mindfulness strategies on cravings, it was found that in many instances, these strategies brought about an immediate reduction in craving. This was published in the peer-reviewed Clinical Psychology Review. And cravings can, well, let's just define them this way. If you have an intense conscious desire, usually to consume a specific food or beverage or drug, that's a craving. There's also a significant body of research that suggests it is casually linked to behavior. For example, craving predicts relapse episode. In substance use and food cravings predict both eating and weight gain. So what you crave, you almost always overconsume. But mindfulness meditation has a long tradition of being used to address cravings. In fact, you could go back to ancient Buddhist text and see that craving leads to suffering but can be avoided through mindfulness meditation practice. And more recently, mindfulness-based interventions have been used to explicitly target cravings with the aim of bringing about clinical relevant changes to behavior. And how would you do this? Well, mindfulness interventions typically employ a range of different types of strategy. For example, they may include exercising. If you're sitting and you're bored, or your legs have not been exercised, they're a little restless, so you start thinking of something that you want that gives you some pleasure, a drink of some type, coffee, a juice, you want some food. More often than not, cravings are for sweet foods or salty and crunchy foods. And in that moment, when that thought starts to happen, you start to having your cravings manifest. If you were just to get up and just to do some 60-second, 1 minute exercise, you could do some squats, quarter squats, three-quarter squats, half squats, but just getting blood flowing into your legs, getting blood flowing into your body, and that suddenly, that mindfulness, you're working on your body. Your body does not need a drug, sugar. It doesn't need it. It just needs to exercise. That's one way that you can help yourself. That's how mindfulness can be a guiding factor. And then just, if I'm, for example, I'm thinking about something, I just make a list of writing it down. I do that every night before I go to sleep, so I don't take those thoughts into sleeping, which can cause you to stay awake or wake up. That's mindfulness, and it works. Also, some people were interested in myopia. Well, myopia is another word for short-sightedness, where you can't see close objects. And if your child frequently complains of not being able to see the blackboard, or if they can't recognize a person from across the street, then you're most likely suffering from myopia. It's a very common condition. So here are some things, according to Natural Blaze, that you can do to help yourself with myopia. First and foremost is outdoor time. Yes, you and children both should spend more quality time outdoors in the greenery rather than staying indoors and watching television or being glued to your phones. Nature provides a soothing effect to the eyes. Also, we don't do it a lot in New York City because we don't really have a sunrise. But if you can get out to where you can watch a sunrise, that's a really good practice. It has a healing effect on your eyes. Going for treks and walks in the woods will do the same. Exercising to maintain good health increases circulation, including the microcirculation to your eyes, and that's really good. And also move your eyes sideways back and forth, and then clockwise and anti-clockwise. This is a small exercise you can do for about a minute. It's good. Also, warming the eyes. Just take a warm cloth and put it over your eyes for about 30 seconds. That releases stress and relaxes your eyes. That's good. And also for reading. Reading is a really nice practice. But at the same time, you should take care of your reading habits. You should never read under dim light or in moving vehicles or in a sleeping posture. That strains your eyes, and that's a bad effect. And make sure that you're consuming your vegetables, especially those spinach, peas, broccoli, carrots that are rich in the carotenoids. They protect your eyes. And then, of course, for natural remedies, I would always recommend Indian gooseberry. You almost always today don't hear that. You'll hear amla, A-M-L-A. It's extremely powerful for your immune system, for cancer, for heart disease, for viruses of any kind. A-M-L-A, plus black currants, grapeseed extract. Those are all natural remedies to help reduce myopia. Coconuts, almonds, anise also are very good. And then you can use eye drops like chamomile. Greatly reduce myopia. Simple things. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We are 21 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world listening in now. I'm Gary Nall. For those of you who took the time to watch the President's State of the Union address, I couldn't believe how utterly manipulative and staged it was, how non-authentic. You walk away with the belief that all we need is to have more military might around the world, and then that's going to solve our problems. And with $1.5 trillion for infrastructure, we're going to build new roads. Well, that's not what we need. We don't need new roads. We got plenty of roads. We could fix our bridges that we need and tunnels. More importantly, we could use at least $2 trillion to de-ghettoize every city in America so that what urbanization has done for those who are wealthy enough to benefit from it, it would make every single community in America a beautiful, sustainable living space for the people there. So nobody would be left out. But his idea of rebuilding America is to turn it all over to corporations who have no experience in anything except making money and lobbying. They would then get huge contracts. They would then hire subcontractors who would then hire local people to actually go in and build a road. But then they would own the road. Then to drive on the road, you would be paying tolls. If you want to see what a nuisance this is, then drive around Orlando and see how many times you're stopped for a toll. Now, these would be long-term contracts. It would bring initially the idea, oh, look, we just got a new road. Yeah. And you're going to be paying for that every time you get on it. And they're going to have that for the next 100 years. So they put up a small amount of money. The government puts up the rest of the money. Local people put up money. In return, they own it. I'm completely 100% opposed to all privatization of all things that the government can do. But I believe local governments, state governments, and the federal government should do things without charging the public. Meaning if it's something in common, then we, the people, are paying for it through our taxation. You, the government, are paying for it by printing money, and that is one way that you could actually benefit the public. You printed over $21 trillion that you gave with nothing as collateral to the major corporations. Why don't you now put that money into local communities. You could do that, but don't have corporate sponsors. Both Democrats and Republicans, especially Hillary and Bill Clinton, they benefit by bringing in people who donate to them through their foundation or big lecture fees. In return, they guide privatized contracts. They've done this repeatedly. That was the uranium deal they did. So, and also all the deals they did in Haiti. So strike that off. You don't resolve a conflict that could be nuclear by building more nuclear. We already have over 7,000 nuclear warheads, more than anyone else in the world. And we should have shut down NATO a long time ago, but instead we posture ourselves that we need $1 trillion more of new warheads. Why? Because the military-industrial complex wants to make the money. They're the ones who are actually going to contract that. The government doesn't make any of this. It subcontracts it all out. There are 200,000 private individuals and corporations in the military-industrial complex group alone. You're talking about several million people. We estimate around 5 million people. Their jobs depend upon contracts being given for something that does not benefit anyone. And more often than not, at least 50% of everything the military does will never be used because it's, even before it's finished, it's already antiquated. Obsolescence has made it worthless. They'll go ahead and be paid the full amount, and it's called cost plus. That means that everything in the world that they could think of to mark off as an expense, they do, and we the people pay for it. Their private jets, we pay for. The Black American Express cards, we pay for. Everything we pay for. And yet these all go to rest in this gigantic, it's larger than all of New York City, all of its boroughs. It's in the Arizona desert, and thousands upon thousands of airplanes are there. And no one even thinks twice about it because it brought jobs to Lockheed Martin and the other Raytheon, all these companies. So the idea that we're going to be more protected because we're spending more on the military is simply a lie. With the best military in the world, with more satellites, surveillance satellites, with more assets on the ground, with the largest military-industrial complex ever created, we could not beat the Taliban, who were using Korean War-grade weaponry, riding on horses and camels and old jalopies and motorcycles, and we're still in a war with them. And he says, now we're going to trick them. We're not going to let them know how long we're going to be there. You know, the truth about Afghanistan was that they were willing to turn over Osama bin Laden, and we didn't. Bush didn't take the deal. But we made a deal with all the warlords, the drug lords. We kept them out of prison. In return of keeping them out of prison and give them rights, they cultivated more poppies under our complete authorization to create heroin that was then shipped into the United States. Not one of them was arrested for this, but we arrested the people on the streets for using heroin and put him in prison for long periods of time. So Trump says two things, that we should let some of the people out of prison try to help them. Why not simply stop them from going to prison by stopping the war on drugs? That wasn't mentioned. That would be reasonable. Start closing down our prisons. We are the most incarcerated conscious nation in the world. We do more incarceration than any other country, including China. So we're doing it wrong, but people profit from the private prison corporation using their labor, you bet, and then having agencies that have become cancers and commit crimes and lie. There was no talking about global warming. He only mentioned the disasters of hurricanes and fires, but not say a word about what we could do to prevent them, what the government could do, what industries could do, because those very industries supported both Democrats and Republicans. So we talk about the idea that we should help people, but we don't tell people how to prevent a disease. That's just stupid. And we didn't have a word about the droughts that are going to be permanent throughout the United States. And the fires now in California, they're permanent. 24/7, there are fires going on in California. That's not going to diminish, that's going to increase. Global water wars. Right now, the biggest challenge to Egypt is not its enemies, ISIS, or battles on the Sinai, but rather that they don't have a drop of water. There's no natural water in all of Egypt, and now they're a battle over the Nile that they get their water from coming through other countries that are diverting so much of it. There's not enough for them for all their needs. Not a word. There was the idea that we should look at companies making so much profits and so much benefit from a tax break that they should hire more people. Just the opposite is happening. If the president had taken the time, he would see that about 70,000 businesses will be closing in the United States in the next 12 months. A lot of businesses closing, a lot of people being unemployed. He's not looking at the real numbers. He said the lowest unemployment level, 4.7%. No, it's 28%. And it's also high for African Americans and Latinos who are not working. But he said that there's zero unemployment, lowest ever. For them, it's not true. He clearly has never walked through ghettos in America or through minority communities to see how many people are living on what's their wage. Yes, there are more African Americans and Latino going to college, graduating, opening up businesses and succeeding, and that's terrific. But what about the ones who have worked in factories and have not been reeducated? So he's avoiding the severity of the problem. Also, in at least 68 cities in the United States, they have criminalized being poor. They also don't allow you to feed the poor. Even when you want to take food to a food bank, they say you can't do it because there's no way they can count the calories and sodium and fat in a particular food. That's not relevant. If you have food that you could give to a food bank, it's the food bank's responsibility to see that it's A, not out of date or bad, and B, that it's something that people could eat, consume. So if you want to give a 100-pound bag of organic brown rice so they can make meals with it, you can't do it because of some stupid bureaucracy and laws that are just completely in defiance of common sense and reason. He talked about how good the programs are for students and homeowners. He didn't mention a $1.4 trillion student loan debt with no capacity for bankruptcy to get out of it. He could have said, in order to help these students engage in life and become a productive part of society, we are going to have debt forgiveness. We forgave Goldman Sachs. We forgave Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase. We're going to forgive all student debt. Let them start fresh. He didn't. Think of the debts of people owning cars, credit cards, medical costs. Think of the return of predatory mortgages and home debt, the return of derivative and exotic financial instrument bubbles. None of that was discussed. It is true that a segment of the American economy is booming, and that's because they've reduced their inventory and they have purchased back their own stock, what is called treasury stock, the stock that's owned by a company, and therefore increase the value of what's remaining because you have less remaining, therefore the value goes up. But that does not in any way, shape, or form help the larger economy or the workers. When bonuses are given, they're generally one-time-only bonuses, and many times those are all 100% tax deductible, so when they're having massive profits by giving out a certain amount of bonus to a certain number of employees, you then write that off so you don't have to pay it in taxes. So it wasn't something that was done in a benevolent manner. It was purely predatory. What else was not discussed is continual income inequality, the failure to address living wage and increase in minimum wage. I mentioned yesterday how Russia has had 1,100% increase, 1,100% in its wages, its monthly earning, in the last 17 years. We've had under 6%. And he won't discuss the fact that corporations have enough profit that they could easily give their employees an increase in wage up to a living wage. They're choosing not to do it. And as a result, frequently people go to work twice a day, from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, then from 5 until late at night, because they don't make enough from one. No mention of acidification of the oceans, no mention of the die-off of major aquatic life, no mention of the heat in the ocean causing the death of tens of thousands of mammals and fish, none. Also, he mentioned he wanted to reduce the price of medicines. That's merely a statement. He's tied completely up to his eyeballs with the pharmaceutical industries, people that he has brought in to run his different cabinets. In point of fact, there was not a word about preventing disease, not a word about how we can prevent heart disease, cancer, dementia, arthritis, obesity, nothing. Because he's the worst of an example, a morbidly obese, pathological liar who is, I'm guessing, an IQ around 12. I'm being optimistic there. This man is the embarrassment in all of American history. Now, I thought George Bush was. He knows nothing. He moves on impulse, and the people around him are what trigger his impulses. And these are all deep state connected people or special interest groups. He did not talk about the epidemic of toxic chemicals polluting our society. He did talk about how great it is to deregulate corporations so they're free of liability. So all the good work that the greatest consumers in American history, there is no human being that's ever lived in America who's done as much for America. No president, not Washington, not Truman, not Lincoln. No one has done anything comparable to Ralph Nader. He is, in my opinion, the greatest single American advocate in our history. And it's shame on the liberals. Well, there's no shame there anyhow. Such dim-witted autocrats and how they go about dealing with anything. They're good at being angry at everything and constructing nothing in its place. Try being constructive sometimes. See how that works for you. And then you have the completely compromised corporate shills in the Republican side. Between the Democrats and Republicans, no wonder you don't have a Ralph Nader who would have been getting us out of problems and keeping us out of these problems. But that's a separate issue, and I've dealt with that, what the world would be like if Nader had become president. But all the good work he did is now being completely undone. So who are you going to complain to when you chose not to become involved in any environmental activity and now your water is too toxic to drink? Your water's like Flint water. But by the way, there's over 2,000 communities in the United States whose water is as polluted as Flint's. And we don't do anything about it. So you've got a polluted environment. You have a total control of our entire political process by special interests and lobbyists. Big pharma, big ag, monolithic ventures like Amazon, Walmart, Google, yeah, the telecom interest, the military, private corporations, the private intelligence companies, Silicon Valley's control of the internet and private advertising interest, the private prison system, the privatization of public services, the charter school system, the evangelical Christian issues. And you don't think that those are important? Those are all important. The erosion of our constitutional rights to surveillance and spy state, not mentioned. The loss of the internet freedom and internet censorship, not mentioned. Targeting and monitoring journalists and activists, not mentioned. The culture of fake news that is dumbing down the public, not mentioned. the right to assemble in public protest without being monitored or considered a domestic terrorist, not mentioned. The U.S. military interventionism and regime change, he did mention it. He bragged about Cuba and Venezuela. Well, exactly what has Cuba done to be a threat to the United States? Or Venezuela, for that matter? It hasn't. But boy, we want their resources, so that got a lot of applause from the fascist, and the building was filled with left and right fascists. What did you do about auditing the Federal Reserve? Nothing. The intelligence agencies? Nothing. What did you talk about Wall Street's influence over the Federal Reserve and the Treasury? Nothing. How about campaign finance reform? How about gerrymandering reform? How about the war on drugs and legalization of marijuana? Nothing. So you see, you talked a lot about nothing, and what you did talk about was completely from illiteracy. It's just an embarrassment. All of Washington is an embarrassment. All the media is an embarrassment. These are all a bunch of punks. They're idiots. They are beneath contempt when it comes to understanding any deeper issue. And that's unfortunate. But that's how I saw it. That's my own personal perspective. Now, just to give you an idea of what you could have learned had we listened to a medical doctor, a doctor who's also a PhD. He's a medical doctor. He's a professor. He is considered one of the most respected scientists in Europe. He's from Denmark, Dr. Gotsis. Let's hear what he has to say about medicine. Now, this would have been an interesting discussion had the president said this verbatim, word for word, about medicine.
Yeah, I'm a director of the Nordic Cochrane Center in Copenhagen and professor of research design and analysis at the University of Copenhagen. 2 years ago, I found out that our prescription drugs are the third leading cause of death after heart disease and cancer. Our drugs kill around 200,000 people in America every year, and half of these people die while they do what their doctors told them. So they die because of the side effects. The other half die because of errors. And it's often the doctors that make the errors, because any drug may come with 20, 30, or 40 warnings, contraindications, precautions, and so on. No doctor in the world knows about all this. So they give patients drugs that they should not have given them, that interact dangerously with other drugs or food items or so on. And then the patients die. That's the other half. So the other thing I found out 2 years ago was that much of what the drug industry does fulfills the criteria for organized crime in U.S. law. And they behave in many ways like the mafia does. They corrupt everyone they can corrupt. They have bought every type of person, even including ministers of health in some countries. So there is a huge amount of corruption. In my country, for example, Denmark, we are regarded as having very little corruption. But yet we have thousands of doctors on industry payroll, although we are just 20,000 doctors. So this is an effective kind of corruption. The drug industry buys the professors first, then chiefs of department, then other chief physicians and so on. They don't buy junior doctors. So when several thousands are on industry payroll, it's really, really bad. And that's why I wrote my book, Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime, How Big Pharma Has Corrupted Healthcare. I hope to convince patients not to take so many drugs, because so many die from the drugs they take. In my country, people take so many drugs that every single citizen can be in treatment with 1.5 drugs from they are born till they die. This is incredible. And drugs are not that helpful. And they kill very many of us. We know that. That's why drugs are the third major killer after heart disease and cancer. So what we need in the coming years is to take far fewer drugs than what we do currently. If we did that, and we were careful, then we could live longer and live better lives. Because drugs have many side effects, and patients often don't realize that when they become worse, that it could be a side effect of the drug, which they continue taking because that's what their doctors tell them. So when I was a specialist in internal medicine, what I very often did was that I stopped a lot of drugs, particularly in elderly people, and it's quite revealing to see a bedridden elderly person come into your ward, and when you stop the drugs, I mean, that person becomes many years younger. And many of these drugs affect the brain, and old people tolerate that very, very badly. They fall, and when they break a hip, a quarter of them die. And for example, antidepressant drugs are used in more than 10% of our elderly. And they seem to kill 3% of them every year. I mean, if 100 old people take an antidepressant for 1 year, 3% of them will die because they fall and break their hip. This is a huge death rate. So a lot of other drugs than antidepressants also make people fall and kill them. And they may affect your cognition, your memory, and all these things. And then they interact in ways that we know almost nothing about. Very many elderly, they take more than 5 drugs a day. And we actually don't know how these drugs interact with each other. What we do know is that all drugs have many effects in the body, and some of them interact also in their metabolism, so that you can get a too high concentration of a drug if you take other drugs simultaneously. So we make a lot of harms that we don't even recognize. I have a pretty colorful collection of things people have called me during all these years. And sometimes journalists have asked me, why do you always look up controversy? And my reply is, I don't. Controversy looks me up. Because it's not popular to tell the truth in healthcare. You will get a lot of enemies. Because a lot of people make money on false premises. Doctors and industry alike. And our drug regulators and our politicians, they are on board on this wagon. So very few people are independent of money in healthcare. And of course, I have attacked a lot of holy cows during my career, and people have screamed loudly. In a French journal, I was called a statistical masturbist because I showed with statistics that mammography screening didn't work and things like that. And I was even accused of scientific misconduct by the Association of the Danish Pharmaceutical Industry, which was completely ludicrous. It was harassment from beginning to end. They came with vague arguments that we cannot recognize the conclusions in your study. And they could have come up with numbers and said, these numbers are wrong. They didn't do anything. It was only harassment. It lasted 18 months, I think, the whole thing. And then when we were acquitted, I made sure that this nasty behavior was described in the British Medical Journal. So after that, they haven't come so much after me, the Danish drug industry. And when my book about organized crime came out, they just lied.
So imagine if Trump had said, we're dealing with an organized crime cartel, giant, with about 20 different players in it. Here's a question for you. Here's some homework for someone to do. This would be part of the research as just one of about a dozen projects. If we are giving such power to an entire industry over our lives, assuming that these people have our life, our health, as their number one priority and not just making profits, then did we do our homework to look at how many of the major companies, let's say the top 15, like Merck and Johnson & Johnson, how many lawsuits have they settled because of deaths and injuries or fraud? Now, I know the answer. I'd like to see if someone in the audience who has access to LexisNexis could come up with the answer. And then you would say, my God, the entire industry is 100% corrupt. That's correct. So why isn't that a basis of discussion? It isn't. In fact, from Alternet, Kate Harveston said, drug companies sell us remedies for problems caused by their own products, and then the federal government helps them. And he goes on to talk about how they create the problem and then want to sell us a phony remedy. So the sick get sicker. You bet. And that's how it works. Time for Talk Back, your opportunity to call in and share your points of view on this. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear from you now with input, questions, suggestions on any of the things that we have discussed. And while you're thinking about calling in or calling in, yesterday I put out a statement that I believe that we should have a nation of citizen journalists, people who are willing to take on researching issues, providing quality insight and information from the facts that are gained. So we're starting with true information. And then from that, we can write articles, we can do documentaries, whatever we choose to do with it, broadcast. But at least we have information, we have a story. And we need hundreds of citizen journalists because we can no longer trust either the mainstream or even the alternative. Think of how many times on Pacifica you've heard programs promoting in the past the White Helmets as being a great group, or the need to invade Syria or Libya. Well, then how are they different than CNN or Fox or any of the other people that support wars? They're not. So here's all you need to do. You can do this work from your home. As long as you can devote, I would say, 5 hours a week to doing research, reading mainly, and then highlighting the things that are important, what you read, and then each person would be given a different project. And that way we can have some citizen research, citizen journalists on a regular weekly basis coming on and discussing what your research has shown. And you would send that over because we have our own scholars and residents who would verify the facts and authenticity. We wouldn't have any, let's say, agent provocateurs trying to plant misinformation. And we're known for our scholarship. We're known for the quality of our research. You'll see that very shortly. You'll see that in the next 2 weeks when we have a major report coming out. So if you would like to be a citizen journalist, then all you do is the following. Send us something about yourself, your background. Send it to PRN, that's Progressive Radio Network, but PRN studio at gmail.com. Again, PRN studio at gmail.com. I'll be getting back in touch with you personally within the next few days and giving you a simple assignment. Everything you can do from your own home or office. All right? But you do have to have a background that allows you to be a critical reader and enough of an intellect to understand what you're reading. That's all. It's not difficult. All right. Let's say hello to Gwen from New York City. Hi, Gwen. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. I'm glad you were talking about these issues. I wanted to tell you that I take a big issue with hearing people like Chris Christie go on TV and talking about the opioid epidemic, because whenever people like him come around or these politicians looking for huge chunks of money, I just think there's something very fishy. And the thing is that the only way that I really think works to eradicate these addictions are free services that are 12-step. Anything that's 12 step is usually the best and most reliable way. And guess what? They're completely free. And usually what I find is that when they talk about these rehab centers, they're simply mimicking the 12 steps, but now they're asking people to pay a lot of money. And in this time, it's going to be us that's going to have to pay a lot of money for these so-called treatment centers. Either that, or they're giving them other kinds of drugs, which still does not eradicate the actual behavior. The behavior is complex, and it doesn't go away in 1 month. So I don't know what your opinion is on this, but I get very suspicious when I hear people coming at me, especially people that are very non-humanitarian, as Chris Christie, to speak on an issue like this, which is very complex, but also could be treated very, very well. There's thousands of 12-step programs all over the country, and they truly work. And they have a reliable history of working. I don't know of one person that ever beat alcohol without going to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very, very rare that people can beat it and stay off of it.
Thank you. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry for the other callers, but we're out of time. I'll be opening our lineup again tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.